antenna that forwarded the data to the entanglement facility. The repeater also sported four legs and two manipulator arms. The hordes of them that dotted the tundra functioned as a single entity. They moved slowly, but quickly enough to disperse or gather themselves as their throughput required. The whole system was distributed over thousands of square kilometers, making it difficult to sabotage and impossible to destroy from space without megatons of explosives. These repeaters were a hardy system, a wartime backup to the vulnerable hardlines, meter-wide cables through which the data usually flowed. Once the Imperials had realized that the compound mind had successfully propagated, they had isolated the facility. The repeaters had been taken offline by hand, hundreds of militia workers moving through the snow on foot and disconnecting the repeaters individually. The facility's input had been reduced to a single hardline connection, a low-bandwidth coupling that the military tightly controlled. Alexander was cut off. The Imperials assumed that any measure undertaken by hundreds of humans by hand would be irreversible without similarly crude measures. But Alexander had other ideas. Hurd looked at the repeater closely. Its power pack seemed out of alignment, tilted to one side at an angle of about 15 degrees. She refocused her eyes into their microscopic mode and noted the simple measure the Imperials had taken. The receivers were still working, still sucking up the vast quantity of data that Legis produced, but the repeater was physically disconnected from its power supply. Tilted those few degrees, the pack was disjunct from its contact. Thus all off-planet transmissions were halted here, a few kilometers from their goal. Hurd approved of the awesome simplicity of it. The thing actually functioned like some pre-spaceflight switch. Again, the crudeness of the Imperials impelled a certain grudging respect from the Rixwoman. With her smallest finger, she clicked the power pack back into the correct position. That was it. The lethal wire and 2,000 kilometers of wilderness protected nothing but this simple switch. Her mission was complete. She crawled slowly back to the edge of the landing zone and buried herself in a few decimeters of the snow foam, leaving only a breathing hole. She would wait here for a few more hours before making her rather noisy escape. Before covering her head, Hurd looked back and saw that the repeater she had fixed was already moving, making its beetle-like way across the snow. Alexander was inside the wire. Senator. It was good to be back in the halls of the Senate Forum. The air seemed to be cleaner here, the wash of politics more pure. The Senate was an unruly chamber, of course, more so now that the special war session was in full swing, but the numberless details of the Senate's agenda balanced each other, blending into a shape as smooth as the rumble of a distant ocean. The noisy debates here were a relief for Nara Oxum after the demands of the War Council, where each crisis came into absolute focus and lives were in play with every vote. "You were right, Niles," she said as they walked together back toward her offices. Oxum had just presented the last few days of the Council's work to the full Senate. "I knew they'd love you, Senator. Even the lackeys were standing by the end." "What about that, Niles?" she said, waving away his praise. The speech had gone well, though. Captain Lawrence Zaya had made them all look brilliant. The Lynx's attack on the Rix battlecruiser had given the Empire its first victory, a gift to the propaganda effort. Counterattacks in an interstellar war could take years to mount, time spans over which even the most resolute society's morale could falter. But Zaya had struck back against the Rix in a matter of days. "In any case, I have my speechwriters to thank for that." Niles began a sputter of protest at this. "I was referring, in any case," she interrupted, "to when you cautioned me about losing my way in the Council, forgetting why we came here. You were right to warn me." "Senator," the old man said, "I never thought that was a likelihood. I just had to say something. I get paid to advise you." Nara smiled at her counselor's clumsy modesty. The world seemed bright to her today. She'd played the Senate like some secularist street gathering back on Vasthold, pulled the bright tracery of their emotions through the courses that Niles's speech had mapped out for her. The moment in which she'd captured them had come early, the critical juncture when she could feel their agreement with the Council's war plan coalescing, reacting to her words like a flock of birds turning in unison. The sharp flavor of the captive crowd still lingered in her mind, and Nara savored the way it blended with the sunlight penetrating the high windows along the Forum Great Hall. But the pleasures of politics were trifles compared to the real source of her joy. Laurent Zai had survived, escaping death again. Of course, only a handful knew that his success in battle had saved an entire world. It seemed fantastic now that the War Council had contemplated something so monstrous. She wondered what the two living councillors who had voted for the Emperor's plan had felt as the hour of genocide had approached. To Senator Nara Oxum, it seemed that she had emerged from the crisis with far more power on the War Council. She'd been the first to vote against the plan, so her voice was now second only to the Emperor's. The once unanimous council was beginning to develop fault lines, the living against the dead, Senator Oxum against the sovereign. The Emperor hadn't lost a vote yet, but Oxum could see him steering away from ideas when she voiced opposition to them, reluctant to force any issue that she might raise a majority against. But the majority was there, silent and waiting to assert itself against any future genocides. In his mind-reading way, Niles interrupted her thoughts. "But if you want some more advice..." "Earn your keep, Roger." He waited another moment until they had crossed the threshold of Nara Oxum's private domain. Her officers had been almost doubled in size to match her new council rank, the ever-mobile walls of the forum pushing against the surrounding senators' territories, a fat man jostling his way onto an elevator. They walked past a score of staff, half of whose names she didn't know yet. When they reached Oxum's personal office, Niles continued, "You are restricted by the 100-year rule, of course." Nara nodded warily. She'd explained to Niles why she couldn't discuss the Council's contingency plan if the links had failed. He was allowed to know of the rule's invocation, but mention of the forbidden topic still made her vaguely nervous. "But I'm not restricted," he continued. "I can make suppositions and give you advice. Let me talk, but don't confirm or deny anything." "Is this a good idea, Roger?" "Nothing in the rule says you can't listen to me, Senator." She nodded slowly. "One, you're happy, Nara Oxum, because your lover survived, because the war took a good turn. But my guess is that you're also happy that the Emperor's contingency plan didn't have to be enacted. He must have had one in case the links failed." Oxum started to nod but willed herself to absolute stillness. No matter how secure her officers were, there were methods of interrogation which could plumb memories of any conversation. They were playing a dangerous game with an ancient law, and although Nara had senatorial privilege, Roger Niles did not. "Two, the Emperor's contingency plan was extraordinary enough that he decided to shroud it with the 100-year rule." Nara blinked, then looked out the window at the noontime effulgence of the capital. "Three, I personally believe that anything too extraordinary would not have the vote of Nara Oxum." She wanted to thank Roger, or at least to smile, but kept her face still. "All of which means," Niles continued, "that you either won the vote and the Emperor is hopping mad at you, or you lost and earned some modest displeasure. In either case, Laurent Zai's victory made this extraordinary plan unnecessary, and his risen majesty looks like a monster for whatever he contemplated. And he's got you to thank for dividing the council. He wanted to spread the guilt." Oxum wondered how Niles had realized all this. Perhaps he had read the faces of the other councillors during her speech, or perhaps he'd detected preparations for the Emperor's plan somewhere among the volumes of data he digested every day. Or maybe the invocation of the rule had been enough, and the rest was Niles's conjecture. "In short," he continued, "you have committed the ultimate sin, winning a moral victory against the Emperor." She couldn't resist. "A moral victory, Niles? I thought you said that was an oxymoron." "It is, Senator. I believe you'll discover that your victory contains several internal contradictions. For example, although it has given you more power than you've ever had, you're also in far greater danger." "Aren't you being dramatic, Niles?" He shook his head. "It couldn't be more obvious, Nara. If I'm right, if I'm not crazy, you've directly antagonized the most powerful single man in the Corwood reaches of the human expansion." She shrugged, returning her face to a neutral mask, and stared out the window. A world had been saved. Her lover was still alive. Niles' warning couldn't completely overshadow the joys of this bright day. But it still troubled her that Niles had deduced all this. Did he have spies on the War Council? Nara Oxum looked at the old man and saw the lines of concern on his smooth face. Then she understood. All the evidence he'd needed had come from Nara herself. He could read her as easily as she could read a crowd. Understanding the masses was a politician's art, but understanding politicians was the necessary genius of a counselor. He was an empath's empath. You call that advice, Roger? She said after a while. No, Senator. I call this advice. Be careful. Move slowly. Watch your back. Assume that the Emperor is setting a trap, waiting for you to make a mistake. Don't. Don't make mistakes? That's good advice, Counselor. It's damn good advice, Senator. The next one could cost us all dearly. She sighed, then nodded. Roger Niles sat finally, sinking heavily into one of her visitor's chairs. There's another thing, Senator. I have to apologize. Oxum's eyes widened. For what, in heaven's name? He swallowed. For saying that Zai's death would be for the best. Ah. Nara thought back on that moment. She'd never been angry at Niles for those words. They'd been his way of alerting her to the peril of loving an officer at the front. It was Niles' job to warn her of danger, as he had done a moment ago. Roger, she said, I know you're glad that Laurent is still alive. His eyes darted away. Of course. No one should lose their lover to war. But at least his death would have been final. Roger, she asked. She'd never seen the hard expression now set on his face. Did I ever tell you why I went into politics, Senator? She tried to recall, but the concept of a Roger Niles before politics was unthinkable. The man was politics. Nara shook her head slowly. The love of my life died when I was 20, he said, forcing the words out slowly. A sudden hemorrhage. She was from old Vasthold aristocracy, in the days of hereditary elevation. Oxen blinked. She'd had no idea that Niles was that old. Before she'd become an imperial senator, he always claimed to spend the time between electoral cycles in cold sleep, only living in the months before elections, extending his life through generations of political battles. But she'd never believed that could really be true. Hereditary elevation? He must be ancient. So when Sarah died, they took her away, he said, made her one of them. He looked out at the window at the bright city. I rejoiced and praised the Emperor, he continued quietly. I saw her in the hospice and she tried to say goodbye to me, but I thought it was just ritual. I assumed she would come back. We were closer than all the lovers in history, I thought. But she didn't return. After a few months, I tracked her to the Grey Enclave where she lived. Oh, Roger, Nara said softly. How awful. Indeed. They really are grey, you know, those towns. As grey as a week-long rain. By then Sarah hardly knew who I was. She would squint when she looked at me as if there were something familiar about my face. But she would only talk about the steam rising from her teapot. If she looked away for even a moment when her eyes returned, they had to learn to remember me all over again. As if I were some faint watermark on reality, less real than the steam. There was no one inside her, Nara. The symbiont is a trick. Death is final. The dead are lost. How did it end, Roger? They politely asked me to leave, and I left. Then I joined the local secularist party and buried myself in the task of burying the dead. Politics, Nara said. We're alike, aren't we? The old counselor nodded in agreement. Nara Oxum had turned to political life to overcome the demons of her childhood. She had turned madness into perception, vulnerability into empathy, a terror of crowds into raw power over them. Roger Niles had turned his hatred into a tactical genius, his supreme loss into relentless purpose. Niles was every bit as fixated as the Emperor, Oxum now saw. Plumbing 1,000 news feeds for every advantage to use against the Greys, Niles was exacting his slow revenge against an immortal foe. Yes, we are the same, Senator, Niles said. We love the living rather than worship the dead, and I'm glad that Laurent Zai is alive. Thank you, Roger. Just do us all a favor and be careful, Senator, so that you're still alive when the captain returns. Nara Oxum smiled calmly and felt newfound power in the expression. Don't worry about me, Counselor. There are more moral victories to come. Captain. Laurent Zai looked down upon the glowing airscreen with displeasure. The bridge was alive again, filled with voices and the floating runes of synesthesia, animated by interface gestures and those of human-to-human communication. palms upturned in frustration, fingers pointed, fists shaken. The air screen showed the frigate's new configuration. In the aftermath of battle, the Lynx was a different ship. Gone were the gunnery stations and drone pilot berths, the launch bays and rows of burn beds. Crew cabins and wreck space had reappeared. Long logee corridors had been created for moving heavy objects up and down the ship, and there were huge new open areas for stripping damaged components down to parts. Zai shook his head. His ship was half-junked. What the battle hadn't destroyed, the repair crews were pulling apart, cannibalizing, robbing Peter to pay Paul. Were the Lynx to face an enemy now, they would be utterly defenseless. But the frigate was well past the Rix battlecruiser. The enemy still pursued them, accelerating at its maximum of 6 G's. But to cancel the 3,000 kps relative velocity between the warships would take the Rix half a day, by which time they'd be 75 million kilometers away. After matching vectors, it would take them another half day to return to the Lynx. Well before that moment came, the frigate would have maneuver capability of its own. The main fusion drive hadn't been touched in the battle. It was, however, the Lynx's only remaining means of creating power. The singularity generator, the frigate's auxiliary energy source, was operable, but the shielding that the engineers had stripped from it was lost now. If the generator were big-banged, there wouldn't be enough countermass to keep the black hole in place. Armor was being stripped from all across the Lynx to build new shielding, but that left her gunnery hardpoints less than hard. Indeed, all the frigate's defensive systems were compromised. With the loss of her bow, the ship had no forward armor. 2 full-time gunnery crews were required to man the forward close-in defenses, picking off any meteoroids that threatened the hurtling ship. The drone magazine had been damaged by flockers, and its launch rail destroyed by the frigate's last desperate acceleration, so there was no way to field a large complement of defensive drones. End of Side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 4. The Killing of Worlds by Scott Westerfeld. Continuing on page 149. Worst of all, the ship's energy sink manifold was gone for good, scattered across millions of kilometers of space. Little hard armor, no defense cloud of drones, no energy sink, Zai lamented. Come at the frigate with kinetic or beam weapons, take your pick. He wouldn't have an answer for either. Processor capability had also been badly hit. No specific system had been lost. The entire system had been designed to gracefully degrade. Synesthesia was a bit fuzzier, expert AI was sluggish, and the ship's reaction to gestural codes was slightly slower, like the annoying lag of a conversation over satellite link. The front quarter of the ship remained in vacuum, waiting for the fissures in the cargo bay bulkhead to be stabilized. Hull alloy was the hardest substance the Empire had ever created, but once it had been virally compromised, it was never the same again. No one in their right mind would go forward of the front gunnery bulkhead without a pressure suit until the ship's bow had been completely refitted. There was also a bad smell aboard the frigate. They were short on water and nitrox, and the bacterial bays that were the basis of the Lynx's biosphere had been disrupted. Large sections of the crew quarters were infected with a rampant mold. The bioprocessing chief, killed by flockers, had been reanimated, but the honored dead were never as practical-minded as they had been in life. Samuel Rees had a great love of low-G bonsai, and Lawrence Zai was far too grey to give strict orders to an immortal. Rees would be spending more time on his beloved trees than the ecosystem. So until the Lynx made port, showering would be rationed. But for the moment they were all breathing. Almost all of them. Zai had lost 32 crew. The flockers had killed 9, and 21 had fallen in the beam weapon attacks. The Rix range-finding laser had holed one side of the Lynx, lancing through to burn, tearing open a swathe of the hull to naked space. In the final attack, chaotic gravitons had given half the crew various sorts of cancer. Even now, the medics were injecting nanos into the worst-hit victims, although these were secondaries. Nanos that cleaned up their larger cousins, the ones who had actually consumed the amok tissue of a gravity burn. Another mutineer had unmasked herself trying to kill Hobbs and had died from decompression. And, of course, there was Telmore Biggs, the engineer rating who had saved the Lynx. A true hero. Unfortunately, along with half of the laser casualties and 8 of the flocker deaths, Biggs would never be reanimated. His body no longer existed except as exotic photons in a sphere that expanded at the constant. In 15 years, some far-sighted telescope array on his home planet of Irin might see the flash of his death. But the Lynx had accomplished her mission. In the hours since the battle, the magnitude of their success and good luck had finally penetrated Captain Zai's exhausted brain. They had destroyed the Rix receiver array, preventing contact between the enemy battlecruiser and the Legis 15 mind, and they were still alive. Captain Lawrence Zai had lived to see an imperial pardon, survived an assassination attempt, and a suicide mission. He had Joachim Marx, Kathry Hobbs, and of course Telmore Biggs to thank so far. But there was still a war on. Their sacrifices and brilliance would be wasted unless Zai and his ship ultimately survived both the Rix and the risen Emperor's displeasure. And it would all be meaningless to Zai unless he saw his love again. He wanted his ship back in fighting shape. "Captain," Hobbs interrupted his thoughts. He turned to look at the woman. It was good to have her back on the bridge, as good as being able to move his artificial limbs again. "Report. We're seeing more acceleration flares from the battlecruiser." Zai shook his head. The Rix were at it again. 2 hours ago, they had launched 2 long-range drones after the Lynx. They were remotes that could make 600 Gs, and they had closed with the frigate in a little over an hour. Gunner Wilson had powered up the dorsal lasers and destroyed them at 30,000 clicks. As defenseless as the frigate might be, it couldn't be threatened by a pair of scout drones. The 2 craft had managed to sweep the Lynx with active sensors, however. The tenacity of the Rix was surprising. Her mission had failed, yet the battlecruiser's captain was still in pursuit, still sending valuable drones to harass and probe the Lynx. True, the frigate had humiliated the larger warship, but it was not like the Rix to seek revenge. Zai wondered if there was something he was missing, some unresolved aspect of this engagement.
"Hobbs."
"Captain? What sort of active sensors are we running?" For a few seconds, Zai watched his executive officer's eyes drift in the middle distance of the ship's infrastructure. "We're focusing all the transluminals on the battlecruiser, sir, and we're still operating close-in-defense sensors at battle level. There are also a few scout drones running point, sweeping for meteoroids, basically."
"Is that all?"
"Captain?" Hobbs couldn't hide her disbelief. 3/4 of our sensor personnel are in hypersleep, sir. They went on alert 6 hours before the rest of the crew."
"When can we wake a few up, Hobbs?"
"Right now, if you want, sir."
"I mean, when can we reasonably wake them up? I don't want to psych anyone."
"We're running hypersleep cycles of 2 hours, sir. I can get you a crew of 4 in 40 minutes without interrupting any dreams."
"Very good. When you have a full crew, refocus some transluminals onto the Rix approach path."
"Their original path into the system, sir?"
"Yes. I just want to make sure that we haven't missed anything."
Hobbs blinked, clearing her secondary vision, her expression sharpened, eyes widening.
"Missed another Rix ship, Captain?"
"I certainly hope we haven't."
"I do as well, Hobbs.
I do as well." Zai turned back to the airscreen. He wondered if he was simply getting in the way of his ship's healing process, waking up what few of the exhausted crew were able to rest, rattling his XO's nerves. Perhaps he should put on a hypersleep helmet himself. The airscreen blur had gotten worse over the last hours, and Zai didn't think it was just the Lynx's processor shortage. It was his brain getting fuzzy, and it took considerable fatigue to blur secondary sight. Zai wondered if he might be tending toward paranoia.
"Hobbs, belay that order. Give anyone you can a full 2 cycles of sleep."
"Yes, sir, but we'll take a look once we're at full strength."
"Certainly. In the meantime, I'll be taking a cycle myself. Be ready to take one when I wake up."
"But we still have 20 repair crew who haven't had a chance."
Captain Zai reached out and touched the bandage on Hobbs's arm. There was still blood on her uniform. Hobbs hadn't even had time to change. He could feel the flechette pistol she now wore strapped to her wrist. It was pulled from the captain's stores. Only the 2 of them knew she had it. There might be other mutineers seeking revenge.
2 more hours awake, Hobbs. Then sleep," he commanded. She nodded in defeat. Before retiring, Zai called up the Legis system picture on his personal visual channel. The Rix had sent an assault craft across the light years to take the Empress and a battlecruiser with a crew of 1,000 to follow up. A considerable commitment to a mission that had failed. Had they sent anything more?
Compound Mind.
Alexander felt the infinitesimal prick in its awareness and exulted. The repeater's senses were terribly limited.
It could see only in a low-grade 4-bit grayscale, its four eyes giving it a mere 180 degrees of peripheral vision. But this narrow, shadowy view was sufficient to find others of its own kind against the snowy background. The compound mind moved its new appendage clumsily across the grainy terrain, closing on another of the repeaters. The 10-meter journey took 90 seconds, the little creature's mobility generally limited to finding sunlight for power and maintaining even distribution of the colony in the event of heavy damage to its numbers. When it reached the other machine, the repeater stepped up onto its back, an armored insect initiating a mating ritual. The device had actually been designed to make such a maneuver impossible. The necessary calculations for complex motion were well beyond the machine's limited internal software. To make the repeater follow its will, Alexander had to swap out the entire contents of its accessible internal memory 1,000 times per second. The gargantuan computational power of the compound mind barreled down the bottleneck of the dim machine's mind like an ocean tide forced through a drinking straw. The mind succeeded, however. The insectoid repeater wrapped a leg around the other's power pack and pulled it fast to the correct position. Now Alexander was two. The little machines set off in opposite directions, each looking for more converts. The compound mind's will propagated like rabies, with each victim compelled to spread it further. Gradually, more and more of the field moved into motion. But Alexander left the software blocks in the civilian network intact, preventing the little machines from receiving any data from the Legis infrastructure and passing it on to the entanglement facility. Let the Imperials be surprised. The compound mind waited for the process within the wire to complete itself, biding its time and watching the maneuvers in space progress. Fisherman. Tide and sunset were elegantly matched. The last red arrows of light struck out from the descending sun, lancing through the waters that tugged gently at Joachim Marx's bare legs. The outflow from the tidal pool grew stronger, widening the sandy channel that connected it to the bay. Joachim felt his motionless feet slowly disappear, subsumed by gradual accumulation, buried by a waterborne drift of sand. He stood utterly still. Joachim did not react when the first few glimmers of light slipped past him. Like floating candles blurred slightly by a few centimeters' depth, they were borne by the quickening current. He waited as a few more drifted by. In the growing dark he could see a faint luminescence over the large tidal pool, a collective glow from its ample population of torchfish, which had lain all day in the shallow water storing the sun's energy. More drifted by. Then he chose one. The fisherman lofted his spear as the torchfish took its curved path, tugged to one side by the eddies encircling his legs. It moved past Joachim and away, meter by meter, heading for the deeper waters of bay. At 10 meters, he threw. The spear flew from his hand quickly, but slowed as it neared the end of its tether field. It penetrated the water without a splash, barely reaching its glowing target, then began to accelerate back toward Joachim as if attached to him by a long, elastic cord. At the spear's tip, a cage of metal fingers held a wriggling form, the fish sparkling in its surprise at being torn from the water. Joachim caught the returning spear, fluidly reversing the motion with which he had thrown it. He regarded the fish. Bright and evenly lit, edged with blues and gently pink at the dorsal fin. He held the spear end out to the edge of the tidal channel where a glass bowl of seawater waited. The spear's terminal claw released the torchfish with a plop, and it fluttered within the bowl, spinning in angry little circles. The fisherman turned from his catch and raised his arm to throw again. The torchfish were flowing out of the tidal pool in small groups now. It had grown almost completely dark, only a few tendrils of deep red lay upon the horizon. He would have to work quickly to fill his bowl. Suddenly, the sky cracked. A long, bright fissure opened, daylight pushing through the broken night sky. The water dried up below Joachim's feet, the white noise of nearby surf sputtering down to a dead signal hum. The burning blue of the sky turned to a familiar cerulean, the signature color of a blanked interface. Someone had woken Master Pilot Joachim Marx up, untimely bounced him from a hyperdream. He'd been deep in the rhythms of hypersleep, and his carefully designed arch of mental recuperation had been shattered. His head rang with the chainsaw noise of torn reality, and his body was racked with the heartburn of incompletely digested exhaustion. "This had better be important," he managed groggily. "It is," came Hobbs's voice. The executive officer gave him a few more seconds, then restarted his primary vision. Marks blinked his gummy eyes. Hobbs was standing here, physically present in his cabin.